folks. This is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCrit Podcast. Alrighty, let's do another episode on emergency neurological life support. Today's topic is ischemic stroke, but not the entire package of ischemic stroke, and not even the area of real interest to ED critical care, which of course is TPA for ischemic stroke. I can't even talk about that. The problem is I don't have the answer. I don't actually know if TPA works for ischemic stroke, and if it does, which patient group it's actually most effective in and which patient groups it's putting the patient at harm without any benefit. I leave that for people smarter than me. I mean, what I would love to do is get folks like Jerry Hoffman, David Newman on one side of the ring, get, John Edlow, Ed Jausch on the other, and let them duke it out. Now, you know, Hoffman, Newman, they're not such physically big guys. You know, they might have a real fight in store for them, but I'd like to get an answer. And I know I am not smart enough, I am not versed enough with all the little intricacies of the research methodologies of the various studies to say for sure whether thrombolytics have a role or not for ischemic stroke. What I can say definitively are two things. I could say one, this cannot be an individual practitioner choice. You can't decide, oh, I believe in lytics or I don't believe in lytics, so this is what I'm going to do for my patients in the emergency department. You absolutely cannot do that. You will be in big, big trouble. What you have to do is you need an institutional policy, an institutional protocol. You need to all sit down together and say, this is what we're going to do as an institution. And then you, as the individual doc, really need to go along with that. You really can't be the iconoclast on this issue. I think that is an insanely dangerous place to be in. So whether you agree with it or not, whatever your institution's doing is probably what you're going to have to do. The second thing I know is if you are going to be a thrombolytic shop, you better give that drug as quickly as possible. You better reduce your door-to-needle time to the minimum you possibly can. And that, my friends, is what this podcast is about. There was just an article published in Neurology by, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher this name, by Ati Maritoja. And it was on reduction of door-to-needle time at their institution. And they have some insanely good times. A lot of these patients were getting their TPA 20 minutes after arrival to the hospital. And there's a whole host of strategies that this institution used to get that time slow. Let me read off their strategies, and then I'll talk about my own ischemic stroke checklist that is appropriate for my practice setting. So let me tell you what Dr. Maritoja and her colleagues did. First thing is they got EMS involvement. They educated dispatchers and EMS personnel. They established a policy of hospital pre-notification. So EMS thinks this is a stroke, they call ahead of time. They, upon that call, notify their laboratory and their CT scan folks that this is a stroke patient and they better clear the decks for this patient. Next, they stop the delay of CT interpretation by waiting for radiology. Instead, the stroke physician, the stroke neurologist, will make the interpretation of the scan. They started pre-mixing their TPA, and we'll talk about that in a bit. They started giving the TPA on the CT scan table. So instead of waiting for the patient to come back to the department, they actually were administering it as soon as they confirmed the patient was a candidate by CT. Next step is the CT was relocated to the emergency department. And I don't know if that was the result of just stroke patients or that was just an institutional change, but that was one of the things that was deemed a reducer of door-to-needle time. They established CT priority, and this is kind of cool, they established in these patients whose EMS notification made them high risk, actually not stopping by the ED, but having EMS transport the patient directly to the CT scan, taking them off the gurney, the EMS gurney, and putting them directly on the CT scanner table. And obviously the ED and stroke folks were there in the CT room waiting for the patient. A rapid neurological exam on the CT table, pre-acquisition of history. So they tried to use the EMS transport time to get as much history as possible. Point of care INR testing, and then reduced imaging. So on a patient who was a TPA candidate And at that institution, for patients, they would normally be getting CT angiograms, CT perfusion studies. They got the CT minus first, interpreted it, decided whether the patient was a TPA candidate, and only then proceeded with the advanced imaging after the TPA was started. So those were the strategies used by Dr. Maritosha. Now, I have really latched on to this as a real issue for ED resuscitation, ED critical care for myself. I think this, the time it takes you to get TPA in on a patient who is a potential candidate is a real marker of how your team is functioning as a resuscitation team. So you know I care about these issues a lot, and I've developed my own little internal way of doing this stuff that now I'm going to share with you, and I've actually codified it into a checklist that you could get by going to the MCRIT site. Now, this checklist is still a work in progress, so don't deem this as gospel and don't deem this as representative of my institution or anything like that. And in fact, I want to hear your comments on it, so check it out. And if you think there's things we could add or change, tell me in the comments or shoot me an email. But let's go through my method of reducing door-to-needle time gained by about 7 years of trying to get this time down as low as possible at the places I work. Okay, let's start off with the EMS call. So EMS in our system notifies us of any possible stroke. We have an incredible EMS system, the fire department in New York. And so they are screening patients for stroke and they will call into their central dispatch line a notification, and then they call us on our little red bat phone. And we get that call. The second we get a call and the word stroke is mentioned or the history is consistent with stroke, we immediately activate our stroke team. We call an emergency number in the hospital and activate our stroke team. And that call activates our neurologist, our stroke attending, our laboratory, our CT scan, our X-ray technicians, and our transporters. And everyone converges on our resuscitation room. The next step in my checklist is to actually get registration in the room as soon as you get that stroke call, and have them bring a portable computer, that's just the way it works in our institution, and then brief them that we want the medical record number as soon as possible, and we will sacrifice perfectly precise information to get that at medical record number. Now, what I mean by that is, a lot of these times the registration folks are told, you know, check through all the old records in the hospital's computer, try to match this patient up by date of birth, and try to find if they've ever been here before so we can link those visits. And that's great for the routine patients because it means you can look at their old medical records and all that stuff, but it takes time, and we don't want to waste that time on these patients. So I tell them, look, give it one shot of, you know, trying to ask them if they've been here before, but then don't look for an old medical record number. Just get us an MR number, ASAP, we could figure out the rest after. Then we print out our stroke packet, and that stroke packet includes the consent form, the TPA indication and contraindication list, the nicardipine and alteplase drip sheets, and the stroke consult sheets, and all that just should print out right away and have it waiting before the patient even gets here. And then verify in our medication cart that alteplase and nicardipine are both present and available. And if they're not, call the pharmacy right now and send someone to pick up those two medications. We routinely stock those at all times, but sometimes the cart might not have been stocked because we just had a stroke patient. You better make sure you have those drugs if you had a stroke call. Okay, now the patient arrives. Perform a finger stick right up front. It's very embarrassing to give TPA to a patient whose glucose is 25. Get an initial set of vitals, but don't get them by placing the patient on the ED monitors. Instead, place them on a transport monitor right now. Get your first set of vitals by putting the patient on the transport monitor, and then the transport monitor is already hooked up and ready to go, and that's where we're looking for our vital signs. You don't need to be ripping off the blood pressure cuff of the ED monitor and changing them over and all that. That's wasting time. At this point, the stroke resident should already be in the room. Hopefully, if not, repage them. You yourself, as the ED doc, should verify the patient has some neurodeficit. We're not looking for the extent of it right now. It's not a problem. It's just, do they have any neurological symptomatology at all? Try to verify that the onset time is 4.5 hours or less. And if you can't, then don't stop. You're going to keep going. But the point is, if they said, yeah, they were fine when they went to bed, you know, 10 hours ago and they woke up like this, then we could stop this rapid movement because they're not a candidate. Start two 20-gauge IVs. only experienced staff should be placing these IVs. It should not be a medical student. It should not be a nursing student. It should be someone who's really good at IVs. They're the only ones who should be placing it because these lines are incredibly important. Having given TPA for stroke through essential line, I have to say that is not a fun situation, and I would never like to have to do that again. So let experienced people start your IVs. Draw your labs. Chemistry, cardiac enzymes, PT, PTT. Draw an extra tube of whatever you put your PTT in because inevitably there's the hemolyzed sample issue. Get a CBC and a type and screen as well. Now, in Dr. Maritoja's study, they have point-of-care INR. And INR and fingerstick are really the only labs you need. That is a great innovation if you can make it happen at your institution. And that would save a bunch of time. But if you don't have it, and we don't yet, then make sure these tubes are drawn. And then the next step on my checklist is have a staff member bring this blood up to the clerk and witness them being put in the chute to go to hematology. Not drop them off and come back to the room. Witness them going in the chute, because a lot of times they just get chucked up front, and our clerks like to batch these samples of hematology, and they batch chemistry so that the chutes are not going off every 10 seconds. And that's a very good policy, but not for these stroke patients. These stroke patients need it to get sent the second it gets brought up front. So ensure that happens. Call hematology and tell them the patient's medical record number so they could optimize getting that PT, PTT back to you as soon as possible. Make sure the CT scan is ordered. That's always embarrassing when you get over there and there's no CT scan order. Place the name band on the patient. Now, here's a really important point. If at this stage the patient's systolic blood pressure is greater than 180, we will start them on nicardipine right now at 5 milligrams an hour. And we won't delay the patient going to CT scan. If we're ready to go, we'll have a nurse go with the patient and start it up as they're getting transferred to the table. But start it now. 5 milligrams an hour is going to do not so much to drop it. And we have practitioners with the patient at all times at CT scan, so we could always pause it if the BP gets too low. But starting it now gives you a better shot at when they get back being closer to that magic number. All right, as soon as you get everything I just discussed ready, go to CT scan. Don't wait for neurology to do a full exam. Don't wait for a full history. Don't wait for verification and collaboration of the history and all that. Just proceed to CT. CT scan is the rate limiting step for all of this. Once the CT is done, then you could perform any additional exam or history you need. But performing it before you go to CT is a waste of time. And as the patient's getting transferred, you can continue talking to the family. So the second you can go to CT, go to CT. For us, neurology goes with the patient to the CT scan. A transporter goes with them. If the patient is at all unstable, if you have any worry about the airway, if you worry about the patient's vital signs, then the ED resident and potentially the ED attending should go as well. While the patient's at CT scan, now is a great time for whoever is not there with the patient to be discussing with the family or witnesses the exact time of onset, how they established this, if there's anyone who could collaborate the timing. And then you could start screening with a family member for any contraindications. What medications do they take? What medical history? What surgeries, et cetera, to actually start knocking off contraindications. When the patient returns from CT scan, if our neurologist still feels the patient is a candidate, we now do a full formal screening for indications and contraindications. Neuro could do whatever exam they deem necessary, and they should get consent at this point. Now, this is a big issue. A lot of the neurologists are going to attempt to convince me that we don't need consent to give TPA, that even with family there, we don't need consent to get TPA. Even with a patient who you could communicate with, we don't need to get consent for TPA. And I just find this to be very troubling. If there's any procedure in the world that deserves good informed consent, it's alteplase for ischemic stroke. It's very, very much a situation of equipoise. And with the definite increase in harm, I think this is the procedure you need to get consent most of all. Now, that doesn't preclude, I think, when there's no one to consent, doing attending-based consent. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying you can't give TPA if there's no consenters. But if there are people who you could talk to about consent, to not get consent, I think, is not the right way to go. But that's solely my opinion, not the opinion of my institutions, not the opinions of the ENLS course. All right. And then at our shop, the neurologist discusses this with a stroke attending by phone. And so that should happen now as well. While all that is happening, if the patient's still a candidate, now's the time to be further treating their blood pressure. And that deserves a little bit of a separate conversation. To my mind, the only drug you should be using for a possible TPA candidate for BP control is nicardipine. Forget about labetalol. Even if you get labetalol to get the blood pressure down before you start, I have very little faith it's going to keep it down during the next 24 hours. And we know if the BP spikes after they get TPA, that's a good way to increase your chances of hemorrhagic conversion. So I'm only using nicardipine. If I had clavidipine, I would use that. That's even better. It's just nicardipine plus, but we don't have that yet. It's not generic, so we use nicardipine. Now, I already told you if their BP was high before you went, you started at 5 milligrams. Now, the manufacturer discusses the slow increase in that dose up to 15. For a TPA candidate, I push it up to 10, 12, 15 very, very quickly, within minutes. I go from 5 to 10 to 15. I watch the BP start to drop, and when I get close to my goal, I'll start dropping down the rate to the point where, you know, if I was at 15 and now I'm at 170, 165, now I'm going to start dropping it down to 8, see where I go. When I hit the 175 mark, I'm gonna drop it right down to 3 milligrams. That's the way this drug is supposed to be given. It starts at 5, gets titrated up until you get the BP response you want, and then drop down to 3. Look at the blood pressure, and then slowly titrate up from the 3. So the way nicardipine is given as a loading dose, which is that initial rate of the infusion, and then it's given as a drip rate, which is the, you know, the consistent infusion rate, and that starts at 3 and gets slowly titrated up. So the way I'll handle these patients is I'll start at 5, very rapidly go to 10, very rapidly go to 15. When I start seeing the BP budging, getting closer where I want, I start dropping down. And the second I get to where I need them to be, I drop down to 3. And then oftentimes I'll have to slowly titrate that back up to 5, 7 to get a steady state dose. But since we have nicardipine in the department, I've not had a patient I couldn't get their blood pressure control for TPA. And that I could not even come close to saying that for labetalol. And what's more important, as I just mentioned, is that the nicardipine can maintain them for the next 24 hours, and I don't think labetalol could do that. Okay, so now we have their BP controlled, mix up the alteplase. Now, I do this myself because nobody, with the exception of some really good resuscitation nurses I work with, can mix alteplase as quick as I can. I'm not telling you that you have to mix up the drug yourself, but you better either be able to do it yourself or know as soon as you got that stroke notification, there's someone in the room who has done this before and knows what they're doing. It's not that tough to do, but you need to know how to do it, or you need someone who knows how to do it and doesn't need to consult the pharmacy about how this gets mixed and all that stuff. It needs to be done. We have a drip sheet that lists all the instructions, but there's some finesse to it. You need to know which vial to spike first. You need to know you can't shake this like a cocktail. You have to gently swirl. You need to know you need to open up the little plastic tab on your administration set because it's a glass bottle and therefore can't collapse. You need to know how to use a drip pump, and you need to make sure you're setting it up in a way that the patient's getting just the right dose. If you know how to do that and you've done this many times, then you mix it up. If you don't, make sure you have someone who does know how to do this. And then finally, administer the alteplase. And with all that, we have managed to get some very, very low times. Now, not as consistently as Dr. Maritoja, but when I'm there, my times, I think, and I'm not bragging about this, but I think my times are insanely good. The best that I've found I could get them down to. There's, you know, some innovations we can make on the institution level that will get them down further, like point of care INR, like having the patient brought directly to CT scan, but we're not ready for that stuff yet. But I've cut out all the fat I could find to get these times as low as possible. Because to sum up, again, I don't know if TPA works, and if it does, I don't know which patients are appropriate. But what I do know is that if you are going to give it, you better give it as quickly as humanly possible. All right, so that's what I have to say about thrombolytics for ischemic stroke. And we're right at the 20-minute mark, but we have to discuss just a couple more things. So I apologize for taking you over the allotted time. The first thing I want to talk about is the art contest. So we've had the submissions. I'm closing submissions now. I'm going to put up in the show notes a link to where you could vote for who the winner is. Now, I know who I think the winner is, but like I said at the beginning of this, the person who's going to get the book is the one who you deem to be the best representation of an MCRIT mascot. And what I realized is a lot of folks don't know what a mascot is. Mascot is not a picture of me. It's a picture of someone. It could be a person. It could be usually an animal that represents MCRIT. And I got some pretty good submissions, and I got one that I think is just incredible. And so I will let you vote. So look in the show notes for that. The second thing is that Rob Warman and I are doing a little project with the Roberts and Hedges book, and we pre-recorded a little spot on that, so I'm going to play that now. So before I do, let me say goodbye to you, and then I'll play that Roberts and Hedges bit. If you don't feel like listening to it, then stop now. And it's been great talking to you about ischemic stroke, another ENLS topic. This is Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying don't go yet because you have to listen to this Roberts and Hedges thing. Bye-bye.
Roberts and Hedges. Procedures and Emergency Medicine.
I've never heard of this book. Can you tell me a little bit about this? What's Roberts and Hedges?
Well, Scott, I would say that Roberts and Hedges is perhaps, actually, I'm not even going to say perhaps. I'm going to say that it is arguably the greatest medical textbook of all time.
Yeah, similar to the Bible. I'd say it might be the Bible of emergency medicine procedures.
Oh, it is. You took the words right out of my mouth. It is, as far as books that I have referenced over the past decade, when the bleep is hitting the fan, Roberts and Hedges, 9 times out of 10. It's Roberts and Hedges and then the interweb.
There you go.
So Scott and I have been asked to be the editors of the video section of Roberts and Hedges. And we are currently in the process of collecting videos for all of the procedures in the Roberts and Hedges textbook. It's really a natural evolution of what you have because you've got static pictures in the book, and the procedures essentially show you how to do it step by step. There are a lot of videos out there, a lot of videos on YouTube and just kind of floating around where people have made their own procedural videos explaining how to do things that are already in the textbook. But what Scott and I would like to do, actually what we're going to do, you know what we're doing right now, is put out a call to our listeners, the listeners of ERCast, the listeners of MCRIT, you know, and the listeners of pretty much everything else.
If they're not listening to one of our two podcasts, they could go screw, I think.
Do you have a medical video? Have you seen a medical video that's one of your favorites? Or, and here's really the important one, do you want to make a medical video explaining a procedure? There's all sorts of ways to go about this. And what we'd like to do is see what kind of creativity can you put into this. Doesn't need to be complicated. It just needs to go through the steps of how you get from A to Z and make the procedure happen. And you can narrate it or you can do whatever you like. It needs to be HIPAA compliant, of course, and it needs to patient confidentiality and all that stuff, and it needs to have passed your hospital's own video guidelines.
If you do make your own video, well, we'd really appreciate it and we'd love to see it, and we might feature it on the blogs and podcasts as well as putting in Roberts and Hedges. But you don't have to make your own video if you don't have the capabilities of doing that. Like Rob said, if you've seen a video you love, send us the link. If you have a video from a colleague and you think it would be really helpful to put in the Roberts and Hedges book, send us the link. Basically, what we want is we want links to every good video out there in the entire world.
And it can be any medical procedure, pretty much, because pretty much Roberts and Hedges has pretty much all, every emergency medicine procedure. Are there any that are not in there? I don't know.
I think if they're not, they will be. We can't promise you that the videos you send us will necessarily make it to Roberts and Hedges. We're going to take the best.
There is no guarantee, but we will take a look at all of them.
That is correct. But if you do get accepted, if you get into that select group of Roberts and Hedges videos, you will get a free copy of the book.
And you will also get credit as being a chapter author in what is arguably the greatest medical textbook of all time.
So send us your videos, please. Rob, tell them how they could get their videos to us.
I just want to put in one more thing about that is that, say you're a resident and you have a research project or you need to have something involved with a textbook. This is a great opportunity. This is like research project 4.0. Is there a 4.0?
I don't know. There might be a 4.0.
You can make a video, you can narrate it, and there you go, Roberts and Hedges.
And it's published, so that counts as your resident research project.
That is a publication.
Boom.
So if you want to submit a video or send us a link to a video, On either of our websites, you will find a link to a submission page. So you click on the link that says submission form for videos for Robertson Hedges, and it will take you to a Google Docs page that says ercast/mcritvideos for Robertson Hedges. And there's a couple of things that you fill in, the timestamp, what's your name, what's the name or description of the video, who created the video, if you know it, and then very importantly, the URL, the link to the video, and also why you think the video should be included in Robertson Hedges. We look forward to seeing what you have.
I can't wait to see them all.